It is nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. We are your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 48 degrees under fair skies. At the airport, they are reporting east winds at 6 miles per hour and 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for mostly sunny skies for the rest of the day with a high near 48. We're there. Calm winds turning to the east to 5. Partly cloudy overnight tonight with a low around 37. Southeast winds to 5 turning to the west around midnight. And for tomorrow, a 30% chance of rain mainly in the afternoon. Cloudy skies tomorrow with the high near 44 and southeast winds to 5. And it looks like rain is likely for the rest of the week. Coming up on the Midday Report, the Alaska House of Representatives passed a bill on Wednesday that would set new rules for property assessments across the state. And the Alaska House of Representatives also passed a ban on social media accounts for kids under 14. Plus, the National Native Boarding School Healing Coalition has sent a team to Alaska to collect stories from boarding school survivors.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Hundreds of students are rallying at this hour on the campus of Columbia University in New York City. They're defying the school's demand that they leave a pro-Palestinian encampment and accept disciplinary action. NPR's Brian Mann is on campus.
Columbia University called on students to leave this encampment or face tougher disciplinary action by 2 p.m. New York City police are massed outside the gates, but the deadline passed and the crowd of student protesters has grown dramatically. Student Saeem Muhammad says they won't leave their tent village unless their demands for divestment are met.
I think we're going to hold our ground. We're pretty strong. I think the movement's strong. I don't see it ending.
With students refusing to budge, Columbia officials face intense pressure from some Republican and Democratic lawmakers in Washington who've labeled these protests anti-Semitic. That's an accusation students here reject. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
Student protest leaders at Columbia say it will require police force to make them leave. Ahead of the deadline to disperse, a large number of uniformed New York City police officers gathered outside campus. In Texas, police are confronting protesters at the University of Austin. Secretary of State Antony Blinken urging Hamas to accept an Israeli offer for a ceasefire in Gaza.
The most effective way to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, to alleviate the suffering of children, women and men, and to create space for a more just and durable solution is to get the ceasefire and hostages home.
Blinken speaking there in Riyadh today, where he said the flow of humanitarian aid must be increased regardless of whether a ceasefire deal is reached. The Biden administration has issued new guidelines for cities struggling with homeless encampments. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports they come as the Supreme Court is considering whether to make it easier to criminalize sleeping outside.
A string of cities and states, both Democratic and Republican-led, want to be able to fine and jail people who refuse a shelter bed. Biden administration officials say even if that's legal, it doesn't mean cities should do it. Policing is expensive and doesn't solve the bigger problem. But when cities do dismantle a homeless encampment for health and safety reasons, the new federal guidelines offer a detailed protocol. One tip, extensive outreach to connect people with shelter and treatment. Another, provide storage for the things shelters don't allow. That's a big reason many decline them. The Supreme Court is expected to issue a decision on punishing unhoused people in late June. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
Authorities in Charlotte, North Carolina say multiple officers were shot and taken to hospitals today. Police say the officers from a U.S. Marshals task force were carrying out an investigation when they came under fire. This is NPR News.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT News, I'm Terry Haynes. The Alaska House of Representatives passed a bill on Wednesday that would put more guardrails on the property assessment process in the state. As KTOO's Clarice Larson reports, supporters say the bill will make the process more fair and transparent for taxpayers.
Last year, many residents in Juneau and Haines said they saw steep jumps in their property assessments, large enough that some questioned whether their assessors were being transparent and fair. Representative Julie Coulomb, an Anchorage Republican, sponsored a bill that she says would tackle some of their concerns.
HB 347 put some baseline requirements in place to protect the taxpayer while preserving the important principle of local control.
The bill would stop assessors from raising a property's value during an appeal, establish new certification standards for assessors, and require a response from the government if you present an appraisal that doesn't match theirs. It also changes the default for who hears tax appeals to an appointed board of equalization instead of the municipality's locally elected officials. Some residents have also urged the legislature to cap how much the assessed value of a property can go up, but neither this bill nor a companion bill in the Senate does that. Representative Sarah Hannon, a Juneau Democrat, calls it a, quote, fairly clean-cut bill, and says it only aims to standardize the appeal process in municipalities across the state, not expand the state's tax authority.
It simply sets up standards to make sure that citizens are treated fairly and have a recourse. And if someone says they're an assessor establishing the tax for you, that you know that they've met a professional standard of governance.
The bill did see some pushback. Representative Jesse Sumner, a Wasilla Republican, argued that putting limits on raising values after appeals could incentivize more people to file them. And he fears big landowners could find new ways to game the system.
I think that we may inadvertently be causing a lot of headache for our local governments in relation to those very large property taxpayers.
But the bill sailed through the House on Wednesday with a wide bipartisan majority, and with Juneau's delegation speaking strongly in favor. The House reconsidered the bill on Friday afternoon, but passed it again. The bill now heads to the Senate. Senator Jesse Kuehl, a Juneau Democrat, introduced a nearly identical bill in the Senate earlier this year. He says he's optimistic the bill will have support there. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
A ban on social media accounts for children under 14 passed the Alaska House on Friday. The bill passed with significant bipartisan support, despite some opposition citing privacy and constitutional concerns. If passed by the Senate and signed into law, the ban would also require 14- and 15-year-olds to get written parental consent before creating social media accounts. The social media proposal was added late in the process as an amendment to another bill and hasn't been subject to public hearings or legislative scrutiny. Homer Republican Representative Sarah Vance sponsored the original bill, which she describes as an effort to protect children from pornography. Vance is one of several members from both parties who say they expect the Senate to make changes to the social media components of the bill.
I want to let everyone know that I'm willing to work with those in the Senate on what the full intent of that is so that we can make this a more robust package and really help do everything that we can to protect our children.
The bill passed by a 33-6 vote with support from Democrats, Republicans, and Independents. But some lawmakers expressed concerns. Representative Genevieve Mina, an Anchorage Democrat who spoke out in support of the social media restrictions for children, says the age verification elements of the bill give her pause.
Age verification technology continues to improve, and there might be a scenario in the future where it is safe enough to protect people from privacy concerns, but really, I am very concerned about privacy for all individuals who might have to comply with this type of commercial age verification technology.
Fairbanks Democratic Representative Ashley Carrick was another of the six votes against the bill. She says she's not sure it will stand up in court.
Alaska has very strict rights to privacy in our Constitution. We're one of the states with some of the most strident and strong languages around right to privacy, and I do think that if this were to be up against a legal challenge, it could definitively probably be ruled as unconstitutional.
Age verification bills aimed at adult websites have a mixed record in federal court, although some recent laws in other states have been allowed to stand. Social media restrictions for children have been blocked on First Amendment grounds by federal courts in some states. The bill would also allow parents to be reimbursed by the state up to $100 a year to pay for parental control software. The package now heads to the Senate. Alaska Native boarding schools are part of Alaska Native history, but with a mixed legacy. For some students, they were a positive experience, but for many who came of age in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, they have been a lifelong source of pain and trauma. The National Native Boarding School Healing Coalition has sent a team across the country to collect stories from boarding school survivors. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, they spent last week in Anchorage to listen and learn.
About 20 people came to the Alaska Native Heritage Center to share their stories about boarding school abuse, some for the very first time.
I don't know why I'm telling you, and I said, because we asked.
Denise Lajmadir helped to found the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition because of the trauma her parents experienced. Her father was 9 years old when he was sent to the Chamawa boarding school after his mother died in the 1918 flu epidemic. He told her he was never hugged nor never shown any love while he was there, but instead experienced harsh discipline.
Papa was pretty free with his belt, but that's the way they learned to parent.
And how the trauma was passed on. Lajmadir is one of the oral historians for this project. She's heard more than 100 different stories, and she's heard bits and pieces of Jim LaBelle's story when he served on the Healing Coalition's board.
We need to sit down. I've said that for a couple years. I'm glad that he will get his story recorded formally, that his kids and great-grandkids and anyone that wants to know what happened to us at boarding schools, they'll be able to access his story.
A story about how he was taken away from his family when he was 8 years old and sent to the Wrangell Institute with his younger brother Kermit. A story that wasn't always well received nor believed.
A lot of people saying, including some of our own Native people saying, that happened a long time ago, get over it. So how do you get over losing ties to your family? And how do you get over losing your identity?
But LaBelle kept telling his story so that others could tell their stories. He's told it many, many times, like at this conference in Wrangell in 2022. He described how small children were stripped down naked when they first arrived, shaved so they were bald, and hosed down in a group. And if they didn't understand how to bathe themselves?
Another matron would use another little child as an example by taking a floor brush with Lysol and scrubbing this little child until parts of his skin bled.
The children were then given a number, which the matrons preferred to use instead of their names. In a hearing last fall, LaBelle told Interior Secretary Deb Haaland that the abuse didn't stop there.
Matrons were sodomizing boys in their beds or in the bathrooms. We saw girls going home in the middle of the school year pregnant, and a lot of these kids are like 11, 12, 13 years old.
Not all children in Native boarding schools suffered abuse, and in more recent years, the boarding school experience has been positive for many. But what happened to Native children decades ago is different. When they were taken from their families and forced to attend religious and government schools, it is what indigenous researchers like Benjamin Jasek call one of America's best-kept secrets.
In order to heal, we need to know what we're healing from.
I'm hoping my story, collectively with all the others that are gathered together, will go way into the future so that future historians and researchers and policymakers can see the harm that was done.
These kinds of things are never the end, they're the beginning of a new future for all of Alaska Native peoples.
Jim LaBelle believes boarding school trauma is the root cause of many of the social ills that afflict our state.
It's kind of multifaceted. Boarding school contributed to the homelessness issues that we've had for the last 40, 50 years in our major cities. Personally, I have had a lot of close friends and relatives go to the streets after boarding school, and a lot of them died on the streets.
LaBelle believes boarding schools also contributed to Alaska's high rate of missing and murdered Indigenous people. He says shedding light on this dark chapter of history may ultimately help more than just the survivors and their families, but our whole state. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
The state of Alaska is appealing its defeat in a lawsuit brought by the federal government over control of salmon fisheries on the Kuskokwim River in southwest Alaska. The Alaska Beacon reports that in a notice published last week with the U.S. District Court for Alaska, the Alaska Department of Law said it was appealing Judge Sharon Gleason's decision to the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. The court's schedule makes a decision unlikely in time for this summer's fishing season. The federal government sued the state in 2022 after the Alaska Department of Fish and Game periodically opened the Kuskokwim River to fishing by all state residents, despite federal orders that limited fishing access amid low returns.
Support for KMXT comes from Alaska's most advanced network. GCI's resilient and redundant network is keeping schools connected across the state. Details at gci.com/education.
The Petersburg School District will join a group that is planning to sue the state for failure to properly fund education. The Petersburg School Board voted unanimously to join the Coalition of Education Equity at their meeting earlier this month. The nonprofit advocates for education policy in Alaska. Executive Director Carolyn Storm addressed the school board at its last meeting.
Our core purpose is to champion adequacy and equity for all kids and holding the state accountable to its constitutional obligation to fund public education and keep public funds in public schools.
The state is constitutionally obligated to adequately fund schools according to past court rulings. The group has been advocating for the past 2 years for a significant, permanent, and inflation-proof increase to the state's per-student funding formula, or base student allocation. Bipartisan education legislation that would have permanently increased the base student allocation by $680 was vetoed by Governor Mike Dunleavy last month. A veto override failed by one vote. It would have been the first significant increase to the state school funding formula since 2016, an operating budget with $175 million in one-time education funding has passed the House and seems to have support in the Senate. It would be equivalent to a $680 per student increase, but just for 1 year. Dunleavy can line item veto some or all of that funding. Storm says the group will file a lawsuit even if the legislature passes one-time education funding, because without dependable funding, districts can't plan long-term, and because a $680 per student increase doesn't come close to what districts really need. 15 school districts in the state are members of the nonprofit. Storm says because education funding is tight, it can be hard for some districts to find the money to pay the $8,000 yearly membership. But she says they're rethinking those fees.
I wasn't part of how the fee structure was set up originally, but it doesn't work for me. So that is in review, so that in fact the smaller districts will pay a much lower membership fee. I don't want the fee to be a barrier to districts joining.
During a presentation to the Petersburg School Board earlier this month, Storm emphasized that the group will not ask member districts to pony up more money for legal fees to pay for the lawsuit against the state. The Coalition for Education Funding has had success with lawsuits in the past. More than a decade ago, it won a suit with the state over construction funding practices that discriminated against rural schools. The group settled with the state in a second lawsuit that alleged the state education system didn't sufficiently support Alaska's underperforming schools. A controversial new graphite mine is taking steps toward construction. The company behind the project, Graphite One, held a community meeting in Nome to share their progress. The economic promise of the mine was met with environmental worry from residents. KNOM's Ben Townsend reports.
As the last of extra chairs, hastily distributed to accommodate the unexpectedly large turnout, were filled, a projector screen glowed at the front of the room. Over 60 people gathered at Old St. Joe's to hear an update from Graphite One, a company building a mine to the north of Nome near the Imerik Basin. The project promises economic revitalization, but also poses significant environmental questions impacting the future of Nome and its surrounding lands. Mike Schaffner, Senior Vice President of Mining for Graphite One, opened the presentation with remarks about the growing demand for graphite mining and processing.
Essentially, right now, the reason there's such a push on graphite is obviously the big increase in electric cars and the drive to decarbonize the environment so that we could stop the global warming.
The U.S. currently relies on graphite imports from China, but with help from a $37.5 million grant from the Department of Defense, Graphite One plans to bring graphite production to the U.S. This includes a new facility in Niles, Ohio, to refine graphite for use in lithium-ion batteries. Plans for the mine have expanded after discussions with major automakers. Schaffner met with representatives from Tesla, Chevy, and Ford for negotiations that led to an increase in production targets.
We're going to make 50,000 tons of graphite at this rate. They all say, great, but we need 20 of you, right? So when we took the tonnage up to 10,000 tons per day, which would make 175,000 tons of graphite concentrate, I went back to them. They said, okay, let's talk. This is big enough that we want to do this. Let's do it.
Community members were invited to ask questions after the presentation, and they focused on the environmental impacts of the project, particularly on water quality and local wildlife. Carrie Amasuk was born and raised in Nome and sat near the back of the hall. She was joined by two friends wearing matching sweaters bearing the phrase, "No one for Graphite One, protect the Kigs," a reference to the Kigliak Mountains the mine will be built near.
Yeah, and it is a scary thought to see this mine go through because it is the location itself is key to our subsistence way of life. You know, the Imerik Basin carries all of our fish to the Pilgrim River, which is one of our rivers that supply our red salmon.
Kevin Torpy, Graphite One's VP of Operations, emphasized understanding local subsistence patterns as part of the environmental impact statement that they'll be required to prepare. Graphite One has also convened a subsistence advisory committee to help incorporate local knowledge into the planning. The Bering Straits Native Corporation has invested $2 million into the project, with the option to invest an additional $6 million down the road. Through this agreement, they plan to help provide jobs and training.
What we want to do now is start working with the young people, getting them going through school, learning the right trades, learning the right careers so that they can work here. And that's why, and you saw this, and it works so well to sign up for PSNC, because that's their objective also, is to make sure there's good jobs in the community.
Construction of the mine is slated to begin in 2027, with the mine expected to be operational by 2029.
For KNOM, I'm Ben Townsend.
Congress has a deal on new air travel measures. I'm Novosapo with a Marketplace Minute. House and Senate negotiators have agreed to a sweeping bill to reauthorize funding for the FAA. Among other things, it requires airports to deploy new technology to prevent collisions and extends recording times on airplane black box devices from 2 to 25 hours. It also requires airlines to accept vouchers and credits for at least 5 years. The Supreme Court has refused to take up Elon Musk's challenge of an SEC settlement requiring that he first vet some statements with Tesla lawyers before posting on X. This came after a 2018 post in which Musk said he had secured funding to take Tesla private. That did not happen. Musk had challenged the settlement on First Amendment grounds. I'm Novosapo with the Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 29th day of April, the year 2024. The sun rose today at 6:21. It will set again at 9:54, giving us 15 hours and 33 minutes of glorious daylight, a gain of 4 minutes and 41 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 69 degrees, set in 2005, and our record low was 22, set in 1937. Currently a rather pleasant 48 degrees under fair skies. Out at the airport, they are showing northeast winds at 7 miles per hour, and they still have 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for mostly sunny skies for the rest of the day with a high near 48. Calm winds becoming easterly about 5 later on today. Partly cloudy overnight with a low around 37, southeast winds to 5 or so, becoming westerly after midnight. And for tomorrow, a 30% chance of rain, mainly after 1 p.m. Cloudy skies tomorrow with a high near 44, southeast winds around 5. We are just about to low tide. That will be in about 10 minutes here on the east side at 12:35 and be a 0-foot tide, followed by a high tide at 7:19 p.m. of 5.6 feet. Over on the west side, your low tide will happen at 12:50 this afternoon, about 20 minutes or so. That will be a 0-foot tide also in Larsen Bay, followed by a high tide at 7:29 p.m. of 10.2 feet. Mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Southwest 15 today and tonight with 4-foot seas. For tomorrow, variable 10, seas to 3 feet. And for Wednesday, southeast 25, seas coming up to 7 feet on Wednesday. Over on the west side, southwest 15 and seas to 4 feet in the Shelikof today. For tonight, variable 10, seas to 3 feet. And for tomorrow, variable 10, seas to 2 feet. Wednesday through Friday on our west side, look for east winds to 20 knots and seas to 5 feet. There will be a meeting of the Fire Protection Area Number 1 Board. They will be having their regular meeting in the Bayside Fire Hall tonight at 5:30 p.m. Tomorrow night, the Solid Waste Advisory Board will be having their regular meeting in the Kodiak Fisheries Research Center's conference room. That will be at 5:15 p.m. And on Thursday, the Assembly will be having its regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. All meetings are open to the public, and meeting packets are available on the Kodiak Island Borough website. Contact the Borough Clerk's Office at 907-486-9310 with any questions. Things happening at the library include the hive checks now. They're having hive checks Monday. Should be happening right now or so. In case of weather, alternate bee-related programs will be held inside. Children under 5 must watch from inside, and kids under 13 must be supervised by a parent or guardian. Sign up online from a link on their webpage or call the library at 486-8686. And the Bridge Club is meeting in about a half hour. Mondays at 1 p.m. they meet at the library. Teens need a calming study place. Tuesdays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. is lo-fi and chill at the library. Unwind with calming lights, lo-fi tunes, and a relaxing atmosphere. Ideal for focused study or just hanging out with friends, and it's for ages 13 and up. Also on Tuesday, the library will be closed from 2:30 to 4:30 p.m. for the groundbreaking of the new fire station. That's happening Tuesday. Wednesdays at 3:30 p.m. is Lego Club. Kids under 10 must be accompanied by an adult. Also on Wednesday at 6:30 p.m., Zoom Trivia. All are welcome to join in on the fun. The link can be found on the library's website under What's Happening at KPL. And Thursdays at 3 p.m. is the next chess club gathering. It's coming up this weekend. Saturday, May 4th, is the Spring Plant Sale. It's a community fundraiser to benefit KMXT, featuring veggies, flower, and herb seedlings, perennials, rhubarb, shrubs, indoor plants, and more. For more information and to donate plants, call or text Marion at 907-539-5009. Senior Citizens of Kodiak's Island Cove Adult Day Program has been helping families to care for their elders for over 35 years. Adults participate in activities to regain strength, do memory work, and stay connected to what's happening in the community and the world. Have you considered adult day services for your mother, father, or spouse? Give them a call at 486-2203 or visit the website kodiakseniorcenter.org.
The Arctic Care Mission is coming to Kodiak. Kodiak Area Native Association is partnering with the U.S. military to bring no-cost healthcare services to the Kodiak community and surrounding villages. Clinic services will be available from May 9th through May 20th at the Daniel Lee Harmon Kodiak Readiness Center and the Kodiak College. There are no special eligibility requirements for accessing Arctic Care services. Details about available services and how to access them will be released soon. To stay up to date on Arctic news, please visit kodiakhealthcare.org or follow the Kodiak Area Native Association Facebook page.